From KCRW, I'm Michael Schneider, filling in for Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
So they come to you and say, here's a thing that is going to be all on screens. And you say, uh-uh.
Yeah, that's exactly what I said. I loved the script. I just wasn't sold on doing it on screens. And in fact, even during the filming of the movie, I kept saying, why don't we drop this whole screen business?
When John Cho got an offer to star in the new movie Searching, a thriller set entirely on computer screens, he didn't have to search for an answer. It was no. Cho explains his initial hesitations about the digital drama, and first-time feature director Anish Chaganty tells us how he convinced his dream lead to swipe right on Searching. But first on the News Banter, Netflix is trying to make its mark on film festival and awards season. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, it's once again festival season, which in turn means movie award season's right around the corner. And Netflix, which has struggled to make many waves in the awards world, is trying again this fall. What do they have up their sleeves?
Well, this is really a coming out season of sorts for Netflix on the movie side. Now, we all know about the Netflix television shows, Stranger Things, 13 Reasons Why, name your TV show. They've won Emmys. They dominate the cultural conversation. But on the film side, Netflix really hasn't made as much of a mark, even though they will cite all sorts of viewership and consumption data that says internally they have an audience. The water cooler conversation around Netflix is not their movies. And this fall, they want to change that. They have six films going to the Venice Film Festival, and they're going to roll them out over the fall season to try to gin up awards attention. And they've got some major filmmakers, Alfonso Cuarón, his follow-up to Gravity, this film called Roma. They have a film from Paul Greengrass called 22 July, which is a terrorism drama. They have a Coen Brothers movie. They have a lot of these prestige-oriented films, and their goal is to try to get buzz, get attention, and draw people to watch movies on Netflix.
Now, Scott Stuber, who heads up film for Netflix, has said that he doesn't want to follow the volume model of just throwing everything up against the wall and seeing what hits. What's the difference with what he's trying to do with film?
Yeah, I mean, that's a contrast to what a lot of people have noted the strategy on the TV side is Netflix wants to create a TV show that appeals to everybody, meaning there is something for kids, there is something for older females, there's something for people who like sci-fi. They're trying to hit every single category on television, but they're being a little bit more selective in films. The messaging we hear is that they want movies that can be impactful in the awards space. They've had a lot of success with the romantic comedy genre and the kinds of movies that the traditional studios aren't making anymore, these mid-budget, kind of lower budget for a studio, but higher than a low budget. And then they're taking swings. They're going for this Michael Bay movie that they greenlit, which is what we're told about $170 million budget. And that is a Ryan Reynolds action thriller, and that is designed to compete directly with the studio tentpoles and will be released on Netflix. So they are taking swings, but they're being a little bit more judicious about how they do it.
Now, Matt, the hottest story in film right now, obviously, is the success of Crazy Rich Asians, which famously passed on a lucrative deal with Netflix in order to unroll in theaters. Now, Amazon has done a great job in theatrical release of their films, but Netflix, on the other hand, really hasn't had much of a strategy. Will that change?
Well, that's been the big difference. Amazon adheres to a theatrical window. They put movies in theaters for a certain time, whether it's a couple months or a couple weeks, and then they migrate to the service. Netflix has been obstinate. They want their movies to premiere day and date, meaning in a few token theaters to appease the filmmaker and to get awards qualification, but primarily they premiere on the Netflix service to keep that Netflix environment the primary place to see the movie. Now, that has hurt them. Filmmakers don't like that. They want the buzz and the attention and the fanfare of the theatrical release, and Crazy Rich Asians is a perfect example. Netflix offered way more money, but the filmmakers knew they had something, and they said, we want this to debut in theaters and become a giant international phenomenon. And so far, at least, Netflix hasn't been able to offer that. And Warner Brothers, which gave them a big theatrical release worldwide, can't offer that. That's the narrative that Netflix wants to change. They don't want to be considered an afterthought or taking the movies that studios pass on. They want to deliver on a filmmaker's promise of getting buzz and awards attention and fanfare for a movie on Netflix.
And speaking of Netflix, you're still seeing huge talent, huge traditional TV talent, even like Chuck Lorre, the man behind The Big Bang Theory and Two and a Half Men, doing shows for the streaming service. Chuck Lorre has a new show coming this fall called The Kominsky Method, starring Michael Douglas. Now, Chuck Lorre, his big show, The Big Bang Theory, after 12 seasons, is going off the air. This is its final season on CBS, and this is truly the end of an era.
I think so. I mean, you know, this has been declared before, oh, the end of the broadcast sitcom. But there really is something important about Big Bang Theory going off the air because it signals the change in the marketplace. It used to be that the incentives to create a big, broad, multi-camera sitcom on a network like CBS wasn't just that it would be a hit on CBS, it was that it could turn into a syndication goldmine. But what we've seen over the past decade is the slow erosion of that market. The syndication world isn't what it was, and there aren't very many shows, if any, these days that will ever see that kind of windfall. And there are various reasons for that. The rise of Netflix and Amazon and a lot of these things around the world are impacting the market. But I do believe that there is a end coming to this broadcast sitcom worldwide phenomenon. And it just makes it more likely that talent is going to follow and not do the kinds of projects that they once did.
Yeah, and that's a problem for the mid-range writers and producers who aren't necessarily getting paid millions of dollars by Netflix, but nonetheless no longer have the ability to really capitalize on that long tail. And in addition, they're just not making TV like this anymore. Talent doesn't want to do 24 episodes. If they can go and do 10 of a prestige project over at HBO or at FX or at Netflix, then they want to do that, and they want to do 3 or 4 of those a year. So TV, as we know, it continues to change, and The Big Bang Theory is another example of a show that as it goes away, it might not be replaced.
Yeah, and interesting, just to bring it back, is that we're seeing a TV show from Amazon, this highly anticipated Julia Roberts project, Homecoming. It's premiering at the Toronto Film Festival. So you have the intermingling here and the film and TV worlds colliding.
All lines are blurred. Thanks, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. In the new movie Searching, John Cho plays David Kim, a father desperate to find his teenage daughter after she fails to return home from a high school study group one night. What makes Searching stand out from every other child-in-peril thriller is the way the drama is presented. The entire story unfolds on a computer screen, populated with emails, video chats, texts, and tweets. With no clue where his daughter Margot might have gone, David starts reaching out to her Facebook friends. He quickly learns that maybe he doesn't know Margot as well as he thought, and that her online friendships don't extend into real life.
She has friends, right?
Define friends.
Do people invite her to things?
I think people occasionally invite her to things.
She just never comes.
She keeps to herself a lot.
She's quiet.
I did see her eat lunch alone.
On Thursday?
Every day.
The director and co-writer of Searching is Anish Chaganty, who first came to the attention of the filmmaking world with a 2014 commercial he made for Google Glass. Searching, which is in theaters now, is his first feature. Searching star John Cho has been acting for more than 20 years. It was in 1999 when his character in American Pie first graced us with the term MILF. More recently, you may know him as Sulu in the new Star Trek movies. When Cho and Chaganty joined Kim Masters in the studio, before they got to Searching, she had to quickly ask about another one of Cho's iconic roles.
At this point in life, I'm deferentially asking, is it annoying to talk about Harold and Kumar? Is it
not
okay?
At all. I have great fondness for Harold and Kumar.
Okay, because I have to ask you, like, you grew up in Glendale.
Mm-hmm.
Your father was a minister.
Yes.
Harold and Kumar, how did that go down?
I don't know whether he was that concerned about the content. He was just happy that I was working.
Did he watch the movies?
I think he thought they were fun. And for him, it was, hey, these American kids, they're making these crazy movies. But I think he also took it in the spirit in which it was intended, which was with a spoonful of sugar.
Yes, how can we capture the spirit in which that was intended? I don't think we can. I actually do not. But so, and the other thing that's I didn't really know this. I feel like I've sort of missed out on it. But not that long ago, like 2 years ago, the starring John Cho hashtag was a thing.
Yes.
And that, do you have any idea how that got started? This was the idea that you should be in this, that, or the other, Bond, whatever, because there weren't leading roles for Asian American men or women that much.
Yeah. There's a man named William Yu, a young man named William Yu, who worked in advertising, and he just sort of had this idea and thought it was a discussion worth having. And what I loved about it, as strange as it was for me to be the face on these memes, what I liked about it was that it was an internet phenomenon. It was a discussion that we couldn't have had 10, 20 years ago. And really, people have been talking about this for a long time through traditional means and really wasn't getting through, it seemed like. But here was this, he just sent out a poster with my face on it. And I think the subtext of those posters was, this isn't silly, is it? Question mark. And I think for the most part, people who looked at it went, no, it's not. Moving on. And it was that quick. And I thought that it was just incredibly economical and incredibly effective. So, yeah.
I mean, did you just wake up one day and there's this hashtag floating around and you're like, damn,
yeah,
that's me.
That's exactly what happened. And I was like, should I be insulted? Are they making fun of me? And I realized it was really just an entry point into the discussion.
And so remarkably, you are the first Asian American lead of a thriller, like a modern...
I guess so. I didn't realize that until...
No, none of us did.
Until... who
was it? We got told. That? Vanity Fair told... Yeah, Vanity Fair told us. The magazine opened its mouth and and said, this is the first mainstream contemporary movie to ever have an Asian American lead.
But there was some thought, Anish, in you casting an Asian American and not making an issue out of it whatsoever, right? You didn't... I don't know the casting process for this film.
Yeah, I mean, I think... Yeah, that everything was a thought, you know, but... Part of the intention was to do something that I felt like no films that I loved growing up did, which was cast someone who is a minority or cast people who don't traditionally get these roles and not address why they're in the film. You know, I think traditionally, if there's an Asian American in a film, there has to be a justification for it. If there's a Middle Eastern in a film, there has to be justification for it. Like, why in this story is that person specific to the story? But, you know, like the movies that I loved, like, they don't justify the protagonist. They don't justify who you are. And I think it was a cool opportunity for us to be like, we're making a movie that is completely outside of that. You know, no one's watching. Let's do what we always wanted to do.
Yeah, this is an example for me of the end game in terms of the parts I want to take. The character David Kim is very specifically Korean-American, and that is, I was unexpectedly moved by seeing a specifically Korean-American whole loving family on screen. So they are specifically Asian, and yet it doesn't matter in terms of the narrative. And so that's, to me, where I want to go from now on. I used to take pride, you know, early on in my career in sort of playing white parts. And certainly that was preferable to something that was underwritten in Asian. But the goal for me is Asian-specific parts that start that way on the page. And so these characters have histories that are specific to where they come from. And yet it doesn't really matter in the story, or it doesn't matter any more than it should. So that's where I want to get to. And I think this film is an example of that.
So you, Anish, you were at Google. You grew up in the States.
Yeah. Yeah. So
my summer maybe or something in India.
Yeah. My family came here, or my parents came here from India, from a state called Andhra Pradesh. But I grew up for the majority of my life in San Jose, California. Setting of the film in Silicon Valley. And then when I was at Google, I was in New York City.
So you went to USC.
Mm-hmm.
And you met your producer there.
Yeah, and my writing partner, same person. He was Sev Ohanian, who co-wrote Searching With Me. I met him because he was my TA.
Right.
And he was a grad student. I was an undergrad student. And I was taking a producing class because the way USC worked was that in order for you to direct a thesis film, you had to take a class in that same class like the semester before in a different capacity. So I picked producing because I was like, that's probably going to put me in the best position to direct the next semester.
Smart.
But I didn't really want to do it. It was just sort of a requirement. But in picking that, I ended up meeting Seven, working closely with Seven, and starting a relationship with him.
So you made this viral commercial.
Yeah.
Which is emotional. Like, yeah. And within 2 hours after it went online, this is a Google Glass commercial. It's kind of funny because the commercial did better than Google Glass.
Oh, boy. That's funny. It was like the most surreal weekend up until this last year of my life. We put it online, and then within a few hours, it started getting traction. In a day, it had 1 million hits. By the end of the weekend, it had 2 million. And, you know, I was just a kid who graduated from film school trying to make a name for himself. And that was the beginning. That was like, if I look back on it now, that was the beginning of the career, you know?
So it's all shot with, you know, the Google Glass. And it's a person who goes on a long voyage to India to present a picture of a little baby sonogram.
Yes.
Tears. Yeah. Little tears here. I'm not an easy weeper.
Was that actually shot on a Google Glass?
Yeah, all shot on Google Glass. And it was, you know, they tried to kind of prove it as like a viable filmmaking tool, but it was like, it would heat up on the side of my face, you know, like the battery, and you'd have to kind of keep it always charged, which would kind of keep it going. It was only a 720p camera or lens. And in order to transfer the footage, you know, it would take this whole other process. And then the monitor you'd be looking at through a Google, like it'd be this little thing on to the right above your right eye. And so the whole time while I'm acting, you know, I'm just sort of like telling the people I'm acting across, like I won't be looking at you, you know, like you'll just have to act against something else, which tends to be a theme in what I do, is just be like, let's give the actors the hardest challenge.
That's so funny. That is weird.
Yeah.
In our movie, I was very frustrated through the course of filming because I couldn't look at a human being in their eyeballs.
I'm heading in that direction. Yeah. I'm getting there.
Coming up after a short break, Anish Chaganty and John Cho tell us why their first phone call was a hashtag fail. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Michael Schneider of IndieWire, filling in for Kim Masters. We're listening to Masters' conversation with actor John Cho and director Anish Chaganty about their new movie Searching, a thriller that takes place entirely on computer screens. Cho plays David Kim, a father whose daughter Margot goes missing. Lacking any real leads, he digs into her digital life, trying to find where she might have gone or who she could be with. Deborah Messing plays Detective Vic, the officer on the case, who at first encourages David's online quest for clues. As he becomes more and more obsessed with filling in every digital detail of his daughter's life, she tells him to stand down.
It means that we can't have someone this close to the case helping investigate it.
All I'm trying to do is to help you find my daughter.
You can't see things clearly.
If it wasn't for me, not you, you and I would both be thinking that my Margot ran away, but because
we
of me...
We don't know that she didn't run away.
Filmmaker Anish Chaganty had spent his fair share of time behind screens working for Google, but the idea to frame an entire movie on a laptop came from an outside production company.
So there's this Russian filmmaker named Timur Bekmambetov, and he has a production company called Basilevs, and they had made a movie called Unfriended that took place on screens.
A horror genre movie. And did very well.
Did very, very well, which is why they wanted to follow it up. And they wanted to follow it up.
So this was their thing, screens.
Yeah. And this is still their thing. And they wanted to do something that was basically a feature film that was comprised of a bunch of short films. And they met with Sev first and were like pitched the idea. And Sev was like, I should tell this to my creative partner who works at Google and does a lot of this. And we came up with an idea for a short film, an 8-minute version of this movie, Searching, that we thought was cinematic and cool and fun, but most of all, not a gimmick. And something that we felt honestly watching the other movies that were like, they didn't really feel like they needed to be told this way. They just felt like they were made because they could be told this way.
Right.
And that was a big kind of a gap for us to kind of cross. But eventually we came up with an idea for an opening scene, which is now the opening scene of this film, that sort of got us creatively invigorated and made us feel like, no, what we can do is could be not only cinematic and engaging and thrilling, but like new and
it's
fresh.
It's this reveal of the family. John's the husband and wife and the little girl grows up.
Yeah, it's we like to call it Up Meets a Google commercial.
Exactly.
You know, it takes you through basically 16 years of a family's life as told to their desktop
computer.
And you're
using, and this is somewhat lost on me because I'm technologically borderline illiterate, but not illiterate, but not great, let's just say.
Sure.
I was like, oh, some of this is old stuff. Like, if you like, you're progressing along with the development of the internet to different services, and you know, Twitter comes into existence and so forth through that. I don't
montage.
Know if it's in that montage. Yeah. Is Twitter in that montage?
Facebook is.
Facebook.
Facebook comes in. MySpace goes away. You know, it's we had like 1,000 other ideas too for those moments, but we live at a point where. New enough in our technological era to basically have just so much ahead of us. And we're old enough to have genuine nostalgia for it, non-ironic nostalgia. And I think that's what we wanted to milk with the opening montage.
So the initial idea of turning that 8-minute thing into a movie you did not like.
No, not at all.
Because you said, ugh, it's a gimmick.
It just, it felt like, you know, we were being asked to stretch something right back into a gimmick again, and most of all, make a film because another movie was a hit as opposed to our movie having any artistic merit to exist. It's not that I was afraid of a challenge, but like it can only be unconventional if it's supporting a better and more emotional story, not the other way around.
Yeah.
And it was until we found the other way around that I felt like, hey, the means that we're telling this story is actually just going to improve the story, not just have a story kind of happen to fit into this mean.
I'm trying to figure out the sequence because at some point you, Anish, acted out every role. And I am really trying to visualize.
Yeah.
And is that going to be on the DVD extras for this movie?
They try to get it on there. I recently saw a sneak peek of a featurette that they're doing on the Blu-ray, and they cut to it a couple of times. So backstory is, you know, in order to make this movie, which is a very, very technically complex movie that took about 2 years to edit, not only are we animating everything on the screen, but on top of it all, there's a camera that's like showing specifically what we want on the screen. It's not always like we're not on a wide shot the whole time. So in order for us to understand what we're making, we basically made the film 7 weeks before even shooting it. And this was Sev's idea to start. We hired the editor 7 weeks before and they started screen capturing the internet and everything. And basically 7 weeks later, we ended up with an hour and 40 minute cut of the movie starring me playing every single role in the film, like the dad, the daughter's friends, the daughter, the detective, everybody. And it was extremely important for A, us to know how to make the movie, but B, you know, it's John's eyes were watching, his face were watching the entire film almost. And he needs to know where every button is, where every cursor needs to go, where every icon pops up, where every face is popping up. So eyelines need to be perfectly matched. And we needed to do that in order for him to have a little more of a clue to what he was doing.
So they come to you and say, here's a thing that is going to be all on screens. And you say,
That's exactly what I said. I loved the script. I just wasn't sold on doing it on screens. And in fact, even during the filming of the movie, I kept saying, why don't we drop this whole screen business? So that was a turn off for me. I think I was just scared also. I was like, I don't know how to do this. It doesn't match up to any experience I've had. I don't know how I can bring my experience to bear on this project shot this way. And frankly, you know, when he and I spoke, it was over the telephone and we just didn't, it was not a love connection because I think
it was. Is that true, Anish? How was the date for you?
It was nerve wracking. There was no love connection.
Okay.
And
okay.
So, you know,
but
it was.
But the audience voted for you guys too.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Thank you, audience.
He didn't take my no. We came back and it was really my questions for him when we finally met were, how's this going to be a movie?
What made you believe?
Well, a couple of things. His assurance that we were making cinema. Then, secondly, it was this agreement that we would pay real attention to making these characters real and authentic and focus on the emotional beats rather than the tech of it all. I was just needed to make sure that we were on the same page. And then lastly, it was Anish himself. I was impressed by him, and then I just sort of caught his enthusiasm. He's a guy that
I get loud. I can get loud and excited.
And I liked him. And I said, you know, I feel like this is maybe.
I mean, did your agent have to say, just meet him? Just meet him. I know you didn't like him on the phone.
My agents, I think my agents were like, if you're into it, do it. If you're not, there's no reason to do something you're not into.
Probably the agent out and said, don't do it.
Right.
You know, I, why?
Right. Why try that? So when you were thinking of casting, mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, Deborah Messing. And John, who came first?
John came first. We wrote the role for John, so it was just, I mean, and John.
So he was, you've done so much work already, basically, and you do you think John's the one?
Yeah, I mean, our philosophy of writing David Kim as the people we are, we're not just thinking about the script. It's just like, okay, who can we actualize this with? And it was John. It was always John. And we wrote the role for John, and it's Kim because John's Korean-American. And John needed to be first because there's a whole family component around him. So we needed to get the green light on John before we started casting with specific parameters. And then Deborah came after. And for my the reasons I love as well is just how against type that role is, you
right.
know? Yeah, you're used to her as just like big and funny, you know, and here she's contained and dramatic.
Even the hair is contained.
Yeah, yeah, hair is contained, hair is contained.
So did she react like John or was
no,
she?
No, I was ready this time, you know.
Oh, you were like... you were in the guinea pig.
I taught
time.
You well.
Yeah, John taught you well. I knew, I went in, I was just like, I'm, because, you know, I had done my second pitch with John to try and convince him and I knew how I should be on a phone call, how I should be as a director. I learned a lot on those 15 minutes when after he said
give
no.
us like the 35, 45 second recap. What did you essentially learn?
Well, the 15 minute call that happened, I felt like he led the conversation. And I didn't get a chance to explain what we wanted to do, why this was different. It was a lot about like him asking questions about the role and not me telling him about the movie. It's sort of project per project, but like the person talking in that call, trying to get someone to do a project should be the guy making the movie telling them why they should do the project, not him poking around figuring out why he should do the project. Or at least it should be much more of a balance. And my call with Deborah was like, this is why I think this movie is going to be awesome. You know, and I didn't say that when I got
pitching.
I was pitching. It was stuff I believed in, but I was pitching.
Those are the best pitches.
I also think like for me, and I can't speak for Deborah, but actors in general, I think, like to be convinced that this movie needs to exist right now. And, you know, you can suss out other things on a phone call, but you know, I can ask questions, but the director needs to be the one to convince me that this movie needs to be born.
Now, you went to Sundance. I guess for once, money was not the issue because the Russians were all up in it.
Yeah.
Money is always
the issue. It's a political show.
Yeah. My fingers were at stake. Yeah, I'm glad the movie turned out.
No, I'm saying they were going to give you the money.
No. Yeah, no. We're very, very thankful that, you know, Timur, who is a very, very kind of already established filmmaker, you know, he made Wanted in America, made the remake of Ben-Hur in America, is big, big Russian filmmaker and producer, just huge in Russia, and also like a big time director here, just wants to take risks and was willing to finance the movie. So, I mean, yeah, I would have loved a bigger budget, you know. It's so weird now that this is a studio movie. Like the other day, someone was just like, hey, I'm in Korea. I just saw a poster of the movie on a bus. And I was like, you saw a poster of our movie on a bus? Like, holy moly. Like, that's insane.
Why
like,
didn't you take a picture
of
our
bus? Yeah, why didn't you take a picture?
It moves.
Do you know who I am? I've never seen anything like that in my life. You know, and it's crazy to see what the scale of the movie feels like it is now, but I can't even stress enough how literally opposite of it was at up until the moment we sold this movie to Sony. It was this movie that just could. No one cared enough really to swat it down because it was a movie made by kids, you know, and we just took a blind shot and we're like in the dark through mist at a bullseye and just hit bullseye without any of us kind of expecting it. And like that movie now is getting the release that it's so cool to me that this can happen, that a bunch of kids can come together, convince a movie star to be in a movie, and we can make a movie that comes out around the world.
Anish Chaganty is the director and John Cho is the star of Searching. Thank you guys so much for coming in.
Thanks for having
us.
Big fan.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can subscribe to The Business as well as to other great KCRW podcasts at kcrw.com/podcasts. And while you're there, check out Screen Grab, a weekly commentary I host about the changing world of television. I'm Michael Schneider. Kim Masters will be back next week on The Business.